Welcome to the News and Perspective. I'm Fritz Will for the Virginia Voice, reading opinions from syndicated columnists, editorials from national newspapers and magazines, and views from experts in their fields. And let's begin today with this article from the April 13th issue of the Wall Street Journal, the Declarations column by Peggy Noonan. America in the Age of O.J. Simpson. His case gave rise to a new kind of fame and left Americans of all races cynical about the law. Our crazy country. The O.J. Simpson case was the beginning of knowing we were crazy and admitting it. It was 30 years ago this June, the murder followed by the Bronco chase, and I find myself wanting to tell those who weren't there what a sensation it was. What an amazement. Everyone over 40 this weekend will be saying, "I'll never forget when I heard the verdict," and, "Did you watch the Bronco?" The case burned itself into our retinas. Everyone in the country was in the path of totality. As much as anything, and more than most, the story was the beginning of the modern media age. It was the beginning of hyper-celebrity and marked by the emotionalism of crowds. Crowds ran to California freeway overpasses on June 17, 1994, to see the Ford Bronco containing Simpson roll by, surrounded by police cruisers. They cheered and pumped their arms. They didn't see it as a tragedy, the story of the beautiful young woman and mother, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her 25-year-old friend, Ron Goldman, who had been brutally stabbed to death. They saw an exciting drama unfolding before their eyes, like Al Capone shooting his way out of a bank heist, surrounded by cops. Simpson was a guy everyone liked, so they cheered. And people watching thought, "Whoa, what are we seeing? What is this?" Some new kind of fame was being presaged. A close friend of O.J.'s, Los Angeles lawyer and businessman, Robert Kardashian, an apparently quiet fellow no one had heard of, was thrust into the case from the beginning. At a news conference, he read a public letter from O.J. just before he turned himself in. The letter said he had nothing to do with Nicole's murder. "I loved her. If we had a problem, it's because I loved her so much." It was classic abusive husband patter. Kardashian, like other O.J. attorneys, would become famous, and the fame would be a lesson to many. After fame comes wealth and power, and everyone gives you a good table. It is probably true that none of this was lost on his former wife, Chris, who had been one of Nicole Simpson's best friends, or on his children, Courtney, Kim, Chloe, and Rob. Their show, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, debuted in 2007. They were the first reality TV family famous for being famous. They are billionaires now. It marked the end of cozy afternoon soap opera entertainment and ushered in a tabloid culture of Kardashians, Jenners, and lesser beings, former Vanity Fair editor Graydon Carter said by email. Also, it made, for a time, Dominic Dunn the most recognized print reporter in the world. Dunn's colorful and breathless reports each month in Vanity Fair covered the case like a blanket. Who snubbed whom in the courtroom? Who said what at Brentwood's glittering dinner tables? The O.J. case didn't create mass celebrity. Hollywood did, in the 1920s. At that time, a young teenager named Betty Davis went, on a lark, to a fortune teller in her small New England town. She recounts in one of her memoirs that the fortune teller read her palm and was puzzled. "Your face will be famous in every corner of the earth," she said. Davis thought that was silly. You can't be famous everywhere. Then, in 1930, at 22, she walked onto her first Hollywood soundstage. Her mind immediately flashed back. This is what the fortune teller meant. But that kind of fame took art or gifts or talent. Now you could be just another crazy American and become a worldwide name. If the signal moment was the Bronco chase, It was a court case that would have lasting significance. It was a prime example of how our legal system got bogged down in distractions, inanities, and poor police and legal work. It dragged on for 9 months. The judge, Lance Ito, also became a celebrity and apparently liked it. He kept 3 open computers on his bench. No one had ever seen that before. Jay Leno on The Tonight Show had a regular sketch, the Dancing Itos. There were endless meandering objections. The prosecutor, Marcia Clark, had to get her hair and makeup done and a new wardrobe. And the cast of characters, Cato Kalin, the house guest who never left, Mark Furman, the police detective who seemed solid on evidence and then was torn apart for having once used racial epithets and was accused of planting evidence. And the phrases have bubbled up from the courtroom and entered the national consciousness. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And, of course, the terrible and historic moment when the jury announced its verdict. The trial felt like it had gone forever, but the verdict came in within a day. No one in America did a bit of work from the moment it was announced that the jury had a verdict. Everyone ran to a TV set. From Robert D. McFadden's O.J. Obit in the New York Times. Quote, even President Bill Clinton left the Oval Office to join his secretaries. In court, cries of yes and oh no were echoed across the nation as the verdict left many black people jubilant and many white people aghast. Unquote. Exactly true. A friend wrote Thursday afternoon, quote, trial as spectacle has been with us for a long time. Think Lizzie Borden, and so have juries doing unusual things. But this seemed to take it to a new level. If memory serves, the volume of the New York Stock Exchange went down to basically nothing for a few minutes as the verdict was announced. That's real, unquote. Reaction famously fell almost completely along racial lines. It was one of those 20th century moments when you realized race is here to stay as an unending factor, an unyielding actor in American life. White and black saw 2 different realities. Whites, all the evidence points to his guilt. He's one of the most admired men in America. Race isn't the story here. Blacks, this is what you do to black men. You railroad them on cooked-up evidence. There's plenty of room for doubt. It showed in some new and unforgettable way the divided country. The verdict itself didn't divide the country. It revealed it, again and not for the last time, as divided. Reaction was called shocking, revelatory. But what it was simpler. It was painful. It left you with a tight and mournful feeling in your throat. Before O.J., American blacks lacked confidence in the legal system. After O.J., everyone lacked confidence in the legal system. It looked cynical, performative, agenda-driven, not on the level. I would say he got away with murder because I believe he was guilty. But in a way, he didn't get away with it. It stalked him the rest of his life. And that is tragedy, too, because he'd been such a hero, a winner of the Heisman Trophy, a football star, a man of great accomplishment whom everyone admired. That's all. The O.J. case revealed so much and started a new age. Within a few years, the internet would become ubiquitous, and at that point, new age would become more so. And that was America in the Age of O.J. Simpson. And that was Peggy Noonan from the April 13th issue of the Wall Street Journal. And next from the April 11th issue of National Review Online, when older doesn't mean wiser. Gen Z may be horrifying, but it's the baby boomers who are failing us. This is by Christian Schneider. The older I grow, wrote H.L. Mencken in 1922, the more I distrust the familiar doctrine that age brings wisdom. The past few years have shown us that there was wisdom in Mencken's observation, as we've witnessed an inversion of the idea that seniors are our greatest knowledge resource. It may no longer be a good idea to respect our elders. The most obvious examples of this phenomenon come from our long-tooth presidential candidates, who dispense ignorance on a daily basis. Each of them, Joe Biden at 81, Donald Trump at 77, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at 70, and why not throw in Cornel West, 70, and Jill Stein, 73, displays a juvenile grasp of truth and reason. Trump, of course, cannot see any event in the world without placing himself directly in the middle of it. What is adolescence other than the inability to see the world outside yourself and properly place yourself in context? When slapped with an order telling him he can't try to intimidate witnesses in his own trials, he declares he will be the modern-day Nelson Mandela. When Easter arrives, he muses that he too must be like Christ, given the unfair persecution he has faced. Who can forget the time Jesus sold gold basketball shoes to avoid crucifixion? Just this week, Trump urged House Republicans to block a reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, not out of any high-minded concern for the monitoring of Americans, but out of his trademark solipsism. "It was illegally used against me and many others. They spied on my campaign," Trump raged on Truth Social. Thus does Trump blaze his way through American politics, lacking both discretion and knowledge of, or interest in, matters larger than himself. But none of this would work if Trump didn't have his enablers. The record is clear. Trump throws a two-month tantrum, and thousands of people attack the U.S. Capitol on his behalf. Trump is credibly charged with breaking the law, and gray-haired senators who should know better capitulate to his dishonest bleedings. In fact, Trump's fan base is aging. In 2016, around 25% of Trump supporters were 65 or older, while in 2024, it has increased to around 36%. Many of these older Republican voters spent their adult lives believing it was important to reduce government regulation, strengthen the rule of law, instill family values, and promote free trade. And yet many of them have forsaken those principles to back a thrice-married, vulgar man who urged his vice president to violate the Constitution, can't find a bad word to say about the world's worst dictators, and wants to slap a 10% tariff on foreign goods. The more our elders see of Trump, the more they like him. Preying on the elderly is despicable, and we often prosecute those who do. Scamming seniors by selling them worthless mortgage plans will land you in jail. Scamming seniors by telling them you actually won a presidential campaign that you lost will get you your party's nomination 4 years later. According to a July 2023 CNN poll, in fact, voters over 65 were the most likely age group to say Joe Biden didn't win the presidency legitimately in 2020, and that there was solid evidence to prove that he was an illegitimate president. But the Democratic Party is saddled with its own boomer problems. In fact, the misdeeds of the geriatric politicians on the left are perhaps even worse. Joe Biden spent nearly four decades in the U.S. Senate as a Democrat who appealed to the working class, but has now sacrificed his principles to the predilections of the Wellesley College faculty lounge. Once ostensibly pro-life, Biden now crows about his plans to make unlimited abortion the law of the land. Just a few years ago, he properly recognized the government's limited role in forgiving student debt. Now, faced with students dyspeptic over his Gaza policy, he is blowing right by an unfavorable Supreme Court ruling, even bragging that he won't let it stop him, and promising to cancel debt taken out by students who accepted it under the condition they would have to pay it back. That, on the pile of misinformation being pumped to young people by Senators Elizabeth Warren, 74, and Bernie Sanders, 82, whose economic musings continue to sully Gen Z minds. For instance, Warren's fact-free crusade against greedflation is so economically illiterate it wouldn't pass muster in a freshman economics class. And yet people in their 20s, still apparently believing in the wisdom of their elders, lap it up as gospel. Sanders' bromides against capitalism demonstrate a mind that has learned virtually nothing during its long sojourn on this earth, while still earning Sanders at least 3 homes. And then the less said the better about Nepo-cook RFK Jr., whose vaccine skepticism, long before the COVID era, it's important to understand, may well have harmed some of the voters he needs the most, those old enough to remember the family whose name he bears. Kennedy perhaps takes science lessons from 74-year-old Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who this week let everyone in on the secret that the moon is a planet made up mostly of gases. And then, of course, there are the elders most responsible for shaping young minds, the university presidents, administrators, and some faculty who continually cave to students who make preposterous demands. This is a first generation of students to attend college because of what they think they can teach their professors. It would be tempting to call it a daycare for young adults, but any actual daycare will be shut down if the grown-ups cowered behind desks while the toddlers ran the place. And of course, not all seniors have turned to the dark side. Many men and women over 65 are appalled at the portion of their age cohort that has descended into the conspiracy world. In fact, while the world frets over the use of social media by young people, it is actually an intense minority of seniors who fire off misinformation at a rate that puts Zoomers to shame. Sure, Gen Zers are annoying with their affinity for socialism, their nonsensical assertions about gender, their cheering on of terrorists, and their never-ending quest for Riz. But they are reaching adulthood at a time when the reigning gerontocracy demonstrates a disrespect for truth and often outright aggression against decency. As Ronald Reagan once said of liberals, the trouble with some baby boomers is not what they're ignorant, is not that they're ignorant, it's just that they know so much that isn't so. The great philosopher Grandpa Simpson once said, "The good Lord lets us grow old for a reason, to gain the wisdom to find fault with everything he's made." But it may be time for some of those who have grown old to acknowledge the fault in themselves. And that was "When Older Doesn't Mean Wiser" by Christian Schneider, and that was from the April 11th issue of National Review Online. And next, from the April 11th issue of the Wall Street Journal, the Wonderland column by Daniel Henniger. The tax revolt returns. From California to New York, people who pay for government are pushing back. One state that Joe Biden can put under the heading of lock and forget is California. It's been sky blue politically for years and would go all in if the Democrats nominated the bluebird of happiness. And they have. Still, California has its uses as a harbinger of things to come, and a big one has surfaced, another tax revolt. A large group of California's businesses and taxpayer associations has assembled enough signatures to put a significant anti-tax measure on the November ballot. Forget the Biden-California vote, this is the one that will count. Called the Taxpayer Protection and Government Accountability Act, the measure would define all levies, charges, and fees as taxes and require a two-thirds public vote to raise local taxes. It would even nullify some post-2022 tax increases that didn't meet the new two-thirds threshold. Sound familiar? This is the second coming of Proposition 13, the California anti-tax initiative that passed in 1978 and became the basis of the National Republican Party's commitment to lower taxes, or anti-tax gospel in the media's derisive phrase. 2 years later, former Governor Ronald Reagan, a proponent of Proposition 13, became president. Reagan cut taxes in 1981 and 1986, and Republican governors have done so ever since. Needless to say, California's current governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom, is appalled. Along with state political officials and union leaders, he has taken out newspaper ads calling the two-thirds tax hurdle, quote, "dangerous, an overreach, and irresponsible," unquote. Opponents also filed a lawsuit to remove the measure from the ballot. Call me irresponsible, but this sounds like the best thing since political activists Howard Jarvis and Paul Gann kick-started California's tax revolt in the 1970s. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is a co-sponsor of the new ballot measure. To the extent the Democratic Party is its own political gospel, one of its evangelists was FDR advisor Harry Hopkins. Hopkins is credited with summarizing the party's reason for being. We will spend and spend and tax and elect and elect. Proposition 13 was primarily about property taxes. In the years since, California's Democrats have raised personal and business taxes, imposed fees, spent lavishly, and gained overwhelming control of the legislature. The Golden State is home to Hopkins' truest believers. The original Proposition 13 came to life not because its advocates opposed taxes for public services, but because the state's liberal political class, including public unions, was incapable of restraint. Liberals and progressives of the sort populating blue states purport that their purpose is merely to support obvious social needs. But today, the big heart looks like an infinitely expandable hot air balloon. Notwithstanding the property tax measure, California's Democrats for the past four decades have taxed and regulated the state into unaffordability for much of the state's population. They've blown through the roof on costs for housing, health care, utilities, and insurance. Unstoppable, California just raised the minimum wage to $20 at fast food restaurants, though its legislators did back off a plan to link utility bills to individual income. They'll be back. In short, the politics and compulsions of social welfare and climate control have siphoned revenue away from basic services. Shift cross-country to New York, which is bumping into the same limits to government growth. Other than crime, New York City's most contentious issue is so-called congestion pricing. The city desperately needs money to rebuild its subways and other disintegrating transportation infrastructure. Solution? Charge drivers entering Midtown Manhattan a $15 fee, which the Transportation Authority would use to leverage billions in new borrowing. There is overwhelming opposition to congestion pricing, both from working-class commuters, truckers, cops, firemen, teachers, and taxi drivers, plumbers, and electricians. One reason New York resorted to congestion pricing is that it has squeezed all the tax turnip dry. All in. Federal, state, city, payroll tax surcharges. New York City's top marginal rate exceeds 50%. The unfazed progressive New York legislature's current budget proposes raising taxes on the wealthiest. But Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul is resisting them in the face of flight from the state, as in California. Across the Hudson River in New Jersey, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy's solution to the state's crumbling transportation system is a proposed corporate transit fee on big companies. There was a time long ago when the proud party of Franklin D. Roosevelt did deliver basic local services. Today, it has become the party of nickel and dime. Some in the current generation of congressional Republicans think the tax cut issue is a Reagan-era relic, preferring instead, like Arizona Senate candidate Kerry Lake, to relieve the burden on middle incomes with tax credits, meaning public payouts. But that effectively abandons the potent issue of who gets taxed and how to Joe Biden and the insatiable Democratic left. To nationalize the tax revolt emerging from California, we all need ways to make sense of the November election. Monday is tax day. And of course, that was this past Monday. Whose tax advisors would you rather have shaping the next four tax days? Joe Biden's or Donald Trump's? And that was The Tax Revolt Returns by Daniel Henniger, and that was from the April 11th issue of the Wall Street Journal. And next from the April 17th issue of National Review Online, throw the anti-American left under the bus. This is by Noah Rothman. You're likely to hear a lot about the polls showing that Americans are growing impatient with Israel. Democrats and their media allies seem to have concluded that this sentiment will grow along a straight-line trajectory, until a majority have become intractably hostile towards Israel's defensive war against Hamas. But straight-line trajectories are inherently fallacious. They take no account of exogenous events, such as, for example, Iran's brazen multi-layered missile and drone attack on Israeli population centers. Indeed, even before that attack, Democratic and media elites had already internalized the misreading of this war and voters' perception of it. For example, a Pew Research Center poll from late March showed that, while the public is growing weary of watching Israel zealously prosecute its right to self-defense, those same voters also understand that Israel's casus belli is just what Hamas's is not, is just, while Hamas's is not. That survey found that only 15% of respondents believe that Israel's reasons for fighting Hamas are not at all or not too valid. By contrast, 49% of respondents don't believe that Hamas's aims or cause are valid. Although 34% said Israel's conduct on the ground in Gaza is completely or somewhat unacceptable, the October 7th massacre that begat this war was seen as an acceptable response to Israel's actions by precisely 4% of American adults. Nearly three-quarters of the Americans surveyed rejected the notion that the barbarity unleashed on 10/7 was a legitimate response to the conditions that prevailed in the Gaza Strip. This dichotomy is something on which America's center-left elites should reflect amid their ongoing efforts to coddle and mollify what can only be described as a pro-terrorism constituency. That description will surely rankle Israel's critics, but what else are you supposed to call a protest movement that burns the American flag while flying Hezbollah's banner high? How else should we regard demonstrators who adorn themselves with keffiyehs and Hamas-style headbands? Terrorist groups such as Hamas kill Americans. What are we to conclude about the intentions of those who praise and mimic them? To the demonstrators who block major thoroughfares, bridges, and airports, thereby frustrating attempts to address medical emergencies and even risking the prospect of a disaster on a flight takeoff, only want to be heard by their elected officials? Or are their intentions far darker than that? Are we to believe that, when these malcontents chant death to America, what they really mean is that Congress and the President should recalibrate America's posture toward Israel to strike a finer balance between human rights concerns and the West's security priorities in the Middle East? Of course not. When they chant death to America, they mean death to America. Whose constituency is this? To its credit, the Biden campaign has distanced itself, albeit gingerly, from the antics of the anti-American left. But it remains beholden to a theory of the 2024 campaign that ensures it can only back away so much lest it sacrifice the crucial state of Michigan, and with it, the White House. His party, meanwhile, plays host to federal elected officials who bend over backward to popularize the slogans that reliably precede the murder of Jews. When it placates this wholly unsympathetic and objectively marginal constituency, does the Democratic Party expect the rest of us not to notice? It's simply not good enough for Biden and his fellow Democrats to gently chide the anti-American left and move on. Throw them under the bus. Pick one, any will do, as this is a target-rich environment, and make an example of him or her. Democrats are clearly afraid of how America's restive students would react to that sort of banal majoritarianism. Whatever backlash that effort engenders among the young, indolent, and miseducated, however violent and disruptive it may be, will not come on the back of Democrats who are bold enough to express their affection for the United States. Indeed, such an outcome might even redound to Democrats' benefit, even if it risks furthering the sense that the party's governing style invites the chaos and lawlessness that Biden's presidency was supposed to remedy. This anti-American cohort has made it its intention to physically attack the symbols of democratic governance. It's high time the president and his allies summon the courage to defend themselves. In doing so, they might convince their dispirited supporters that the president's party is not a spent force bereft of self-confidence and a healthy sense of patriotism. The alternative is to allow the provocateurs and agitators in America's streets to set the terms of the debate and dictate the tempo of events. To allow that to continue is politically suicidal. That was Throw the Anti-American Left Under the Bus, and that was by Noah Rothman from the April 17th issue of National Review Online. And you're listening to the News and Perspective on Virginia Voice. Let's continue with this article from the April 13th issue of the Wall Street Journal, the Business World column by Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. Trump has a plan for Ukraine. It's Biden's. Whoever wins, Europe might get ready for a period of lackluster American leadership. Like a slim majority of Americans and strong majority of pundits, I disagree with the House GOP rump seeking to stop aid to Ukraine. But America has a two-party adversarial political system. It isn't a polity of enforced unanimity. Nothing is ever unopposed. 48 House Democrats voted against the creation of Medicare. We are one president at a time, and Joe Biden has been pro-Ukraine only in comparison to the GOP renegades. He has consistently withheld requested weapons, fearing escalation as if Vladimir Putin might commit global suicide because a war outside his borders is going badly. Did the U.S. resort to nukes in Iraq? This column thought Mr. Biden should be more enterprising in the early days, when Mr. Putin was flummoxed by failure, before sunk costs and thousands of deaths had to be justified. But Biden policy has been suspiciously unnimble, with perhaps the main instruction to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan being, keep the war of low salience to the American voter. A frozen Korea-style outcome may have been the lightly spoken Biden aim all along. Now comes a Washington Post report detailing a secret Donald Trump plan that strikes fundamentally the same note. Last time I wrote about this subject, a reader texted me with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who claimed Mr. Trump in private vowed to cut off Ukraine. My response, Orban speaks for Orban. He was speaking to a Hungarian audience. I wasn't there to question him about exactly what Trump said or what he thought he heard Trump say, but if Trump wanted to say something intelligible on Ukraine, he would. Not surprisingly, the Post now tells us Mr. Orban's claim was categorically false. Mr. Trump, his critics are correct, has no fixed star. He wants outcomes that glorify Mr. Trump. These same critics, incapable of consistency whenever a cheap talking point beckons, actually credit him with one fixed and consistent position, pro-Putin and anti-Ukraine. When you hear this, you're hearing hackery. It's a complete misunderstanding of who Mr. Trump is and how he operates. Nor does it help. The great navigational shoal in this war isn't Russia's interest, it's Ukraine's. The Zelensky government has been unwilling to explain to its public that even if Russian forces could somehow be expelled, it would be a temporary outcome. Ukraine is a weak polity. It won't level with its people about the real price of victory, a long cold war until Russia changes, yet neither will it draft its young into the fight. Mr. Putin's is a weak polity, squandering its troops rather than husbanding them for a decisive offensive, refusing to impinge on its urban elite with conscription. The Kremlin's budgeting indicates its effort must peak this year. The collective war West is proving weak too. Gifted with an undeserved strategic opportunity, armed with 20 times Russia's GDP, NATO could stop the war tomorrow by writing a sizable but affordable check to deny Mr. Putin hope of further advances. In this situation, Mr. Trump, it's a slight oversimplification to say, is high risk and high reward, and Mr. Biden is low risk and low reward. In fact, it's hard to see how much good happening either way. With Mr. Trump, there's a slight chance of some out-of-the-left-field deal, but your main expectation should be very similar whoever is elected. High-baked drift, unless and until the Russians mount a competent threat to capture Kyiv, then a panicked, unpredictable response. U.S. management of recent wars shouldn't fill voters with confidence. Neither should its management of the Trump phenomenon. The collapse of elite credit with a large part of our electorate, those now supporting the GOP isolationist wing, is directly traceable to the lame Russia hoaxes that were the elite answer to the Trump's electorate message of dissatisfaction. In his most important job, healing this breach, Mr. Biden quickly went AWOL, then added insult to injury by specifying electric vehicle handouts and student loan forgiveness as his new agenda. Against all evidence, he now decides America wants him for a second term, missing the opportunity history sometimes gives a one-term president to advance difficult, unpopular, necessary decisions that a hostile world requires, even if the electorate hasn't caught up with the realities yet. The failing spirit turns to a deus ex machina in such circumstances. How bad could Kamala Harris be? Three of the last four vice presidents who acceded unexpectedly to the presidency, T.R., Coolidge, Truman, worked out fine. LBJ was the exception, using his fortuitous elevation to launch agendas that mostly played out poorly for America. Failing some wild card, I would advise Ukraine's European friends to be ready for an extended period in which the U.S. is unable to provide leadership amid the rising dangers of the world. And that was Trump Has a Plan for Ukraine. It's Biden's. And that was by Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. from the April 13th issue of the Wall Street Journal. And next from the April 17th issue of the Federalist. Don't fall for Democrats' dishonest, unconstitutional, norm-busting, vote-pying student loan racket. This is How Do You Do, Fellow Kids? And this is by David Arsenyi. Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren released a cringy video appeal to young voters this week, letting them know that Senate Democrats were integral in the White House's efforts to cancel student debt. Sure, they're bragging about settling the average taxpayer with the debt of the privileged college graduates. But let's not overlook the fact that Warren and Schumer are also bragging about helping the president circumvent the institution they supposedly run. It is no surprise a leader of what is allegedly the greatest deliberative lawmaking body in the world, tasked with checking the power of the executive branch, is telling us he will sell out the legislative branch for a few votes. A few years back, Schumer told Rachel Maddow it may be a, quote, good idea for President Biden to call a climate emergency, unquote, which would have given the White House nearly unfettered power to run the economy by fiat. If President Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis or Joe McRedstate took the same power, Schumer would rend his garments. These are the same people, incidentally, who've deputized themselves as democracy's great defenders. Thank you, heroes. For partisan Democrats who don't give a whit about constitutional order, the student loan racket has no real downside. Biden's promise to relieve borrowers of their responsibilities and life choices may well help him pick up a few younger voters. They tell me student loan forgiveness, a favorite euphemism of Democrats and thus the media, is quite popular in the polls. And why not? Forgiveness is an optimistic word that makes it sound as if the loans are magically dissipating into the ether. It should be obvious to anyone with a brain, even people with college degrees, that the president has neither the constitutional authority nor the real-world ability to forgive loans that have been already borrowed and spent. Biden can unilaterally break existing contracts and transfer the cost of these loans onto others, many of whom have either repaid their own student loans or never borrowed any money to begin with. I do wonder what opinion polls would look like if pollsters started asking voters whether they believe their children should be on the hook for a stranger's Ph.D. in journalism or gender studies. My guess is that we would see significantly different numbers. Now, as for Republicans who attack the plan, Democrats will merely accuse them of hypocrisy and wanting to undermine the future. If there is anything conservatives hate more than children, it's children with an education. That's only the start. Quote, Republicans are suing to make sure that Americans have to pay more in student loans, to make sure that you had to pay more interest to banks on your student loans, unquote, was, for instance, the mind-blowingly dishonest way that Madoff framed the case against Biden's power grab. Which reminds me that loan forgiveness also poses a serious moral hazard. There are no limits to the types of degrees we will be forgiving. Take Madoff, who earned a bachelor's degree in public policy and a doctorate in political science. If anything, we should be paying Americans not to get useless degrees that turn them into insufferable authoritarian nuisances, not egging them on. Then again, the White House has been similarly dishonestly accusing Biden's student loan scheme of having benefited from the Paycheck Protection Program. This is bunk, of course. The state sent PPP checks so that employment wouldn't crater after it forced the economy to shut down. No one compelled you to borrow $200,000 for that political science degree. Unlike student loans, PPP was intended to be a cash transfer from the government. The loans were structured to be forgivable. No one broke a contract. No one in the White House changed the parameters of those contracts because would-be voters began whining. Indeed, the president didn't transfer the responsibility of PPP payments to other businesses by decree. The law was passed by Congress, not declared by some corrupt politician desperate to stay in office. Nor, it should be noted, is the student bailout anything like any corporate bailouts that were meant to save industries and jobs. They may have been wrong and counterproductive, but they were passed by the legislature. The White House is basically just shaming Republicans for trusting the government to help them. So, come to think of it, maybe they deserve it. Finally, if Biden fails and the Supreme Court yet again overturns another student loan forgiveness scam because it is a clear usurpation of the separation of power, Democrats will just turn their attention back to their favorite pastime of smearing and delegitimizing the court. For partisan Democrats, it's a win-win-win. For the constitutional order, it's a disaster, as usual. And that was Don't Fall for Democrats' Dishonest, Unconstitutional, Norm-Busting, Vote-Buying Student Loan Racket. And that was by David Arsenyi in the April 17th issue of The Federalist. And next, in the April 9th issue of The Wall Street Journal, the Global View column by Walter Russell Mead. Does Biden take China's threat seriously? His diplomacy is provocative, but his defense strategy isn't preventive enough. After 6 months in which the Middle East seemed to suck all the oxygen out of the Oval Office, the White House is pivoting to the Indo-Pacific this week as Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida arrives for consultations and a state dinner. President Biden and Mr. Kishida will be joined Thursday by Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. for talks on China's growing military threat to the Philippines. The deepening security relationship with an increasingly activist Japan is the heart of America's strategy, which illustrates both the potential and possible pitfalls in Team Biden's approach. As China's power has grown and it has cast off the peaceful rise policy of Deng Xiaoping's era, Tokyo sees Beijing's ambitions as a direct and increasingly urgent threat to its security and independence. If China compels Taiwan to unite with the mainland and makes good on its sweeping claims in the South China Sea, Beijing will be able to restrict Japan's trade with the world. Tokyo is responding to this threat, made more powerful by China's growing alliance with Russia, by increasing defense spending, strengthening its security relationship with the U.S., and enhancing military cooperation and engagement with neighbors like the Philippines. Yet close American cooperation with Japan comes at a cost. Chinese nationalists see Japan as China's greatest historical enemy, and the U.S. is China's most powerful contemporary opponent. Photos of Mr. Kishida clinking champagne flutes with Mr. Biden will inflame Chinese public opinion and allow regime propagandists to whip up support for Xi Jinping at a time of economic stress. Most Westerners yawn when they read official Chinese documents, but as Steve Tsang and Olivia Chung wrote in the concise and important new book, The Political Thought of Xi Jinping, there's much to be learned from them. A vision of zero-sum competition with the U.S. is at the heart of China's approach to international politics, and hostility toward Japan is central to the Communist Party's goal of uniting the Chinese people behind Mr. Xi and the party elite. In 2014, Mr. Xi added three memorial days to the Chinese calendar, celebrated with marches and events throughout the country. Two of the three are explicitly anti-Japan. One commemorates the victims of the 1937 Nanjing Massacre, and the other celebrates Japan's defeat in World War II. Chinese textbooks and curricula have been revised to highlight the evil intentions and relentless ambition of Japan and the U.S. The idea that national unity under communist leadership is a way to frustrate China's foreign enemies is central to regime propaganda. We should make no mistake. Both elite and mass Chinese public opinion will read this week's U.S.-Japan summit as a serious escalation of Washington's direct challenge to Mr. Xi and his goal of unification with Taiwan. The question is whether the Biden administration and the country it leads are prepared for the blowback. With widely respected Asia hand Kirk Campbell at the number two spot in the State Department after his February Senate confirmation, a chief architect of America's Asian diplomatic strategy is well placed to keep strengthening and integrating America's virtual alliances and partnerships across the Indo-Pacific. Yet old questions linger. Does Mr. Biden understand how serious the challenge from China is? Does he have a plan for American and allied success? Is he willing and able to give his military and diplomatic teams the resources and political support they need? Not everybody in Asia is convinced the answer is yes. An annual survey of business, political, and civil society actors by the Singapore-based ISEAS Yusof Ishak Institute found for the first time this year that a slim majority of Southeast Asian leaders would, if forced to choose, opt for China over the U.S. as their preferred alignment choice in the region. Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia were among the countries where majorities would choose China in a pinch. Those skeptical Southeast Asians are onto something. America's failure to match China's epochal military buildup, not a lack of diplomatic activism, is the root cause of the region's geopolitical insecurity. Better security cooperation with Japan, a goal of this week's talks, can help at the margins, but a serious policy for the Indo-Pacific requires larger investments from the U.S., and Team Biden is currently ready to provide. As a result, American policy in Asia is to speak loudly while brandishing a small stick. If we persist, it won't matter how many toasts American and Japanese leaders drink together or how many memos of understanding they sign. Unless we get the basics right, Mr. Xi's China will one day call our bluff. That was "Does Biden Take China's Threat Seriously?" And that was by Walter Russell Meade from the April 9th issue of the Wall Street Journal. And next, from the April 17th issue of the Dispatch, "The Problem with Biden's Don't Doctrine." The president's emphasis on de-escalation ignores that geopolitical instability didn't start on October 7th. This is by Jonah Goldberg. After Iran's massive drone and missile attack on Israel Saturday, President Biden reportedly told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, "You gotta win, take the win." Most of the weapons, the first Iran had ever fired on Israel from its own territory, were successfully intercepted. "From its own territory" is a very loaded qualifier. It speaks to both the complexity and the stupidity of the situation. Iran has been attacking Israel for decades, but not from its own soil. Instead, Iran has given Hamas and Hezbollah weapons, training, and other support to do its dirty work from Lebanon and the Palestinian territories. Indeed, it's clarifying to think of Hamas and Hezbollah as Iranian drones in human form. If your neighbor hired and equipped agents to throw Molotov cocktails into your home and worse, you probably wouldn't think it was a particularly meaningful distinction that they didn't do so from his property. And if you prevented the Molotov cocktails from doing much damage with the help of other neighbors, you might not regard take the win, as the soundest advice. Geopolitical deterrence is often a stupidity agreed on with sophistication. That's because perception, of strength, resolve, and so on is an essential part of statecraft. Iran felt it had to retaliate following an Israeli attack on its consulate in Syria this month. Among those killed in that attack was General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, an Iranian Revolutionary Guard leader who, according to Israel, played a key role in the planning and execution of Hamas's October 7th attack. That's part of the stupidity of deterrence doctrine. Every rung on the escalatory ladder may be treated by one side or the other as the beginning or end of hostilities. That's partly why so many enemies of Israel started calling for ceasefire before Israel had even responded to October 7th. Even before the Iranian attack hit Saturday, Iran's UN delegation announced the matter could be deemed concluded. But from Israel's perspective, firing some 300 drones and ballistic missiles at its territory can't go unanswered. Deterrence demands that Iran understand such aggression has consequences. Biden disagrees. Because America and other allies helped Israel intercept the drones and missiles, he believes Israel should stand down and take the win. Our aim is to de-escalate regional tensions, a senior Biden official told the Washington Post. It's a reasonable desire, but for Israel, not necessarily a reasonable request. What's clearly unreasonable are the demands for restraint from opponents of U.S. military aid for Israel, insisting that Israel shouldn't retaliate because its U.S.-funded defense systems successfully blocked an attack is logically and morally incompatible with calling for an end to American aid. With those defenses, thousands of Israelis might have died, and Israel would have no choice but to respond offensively, which could ignite the regional war everybody wants to avoid. But the real problem isn't with the perception of Israel's willingness to defend itself. It's with Biden's and America's willingness to deter our adversaries. After October 7th, Biden had a one-word message for Iran and other bad actors seeking to take advantage of the situation. Don't. Iran ignored that advice Saturday, but it also ignored it months earlier when Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Iranian-backed Houthis attacked Israel in Western shipping. Moreover, regional and geopolitical instability didn't start on October 7th. Biden's early abandonment of the U.S.-backed government in Afghanistan arguably started this cascade of uncertainty. Vladimir Putin may have seen it as a sign of Western weakness, contributing to his decision to invade Ukraine. Biden's subsequent vow to provide Ukraine with whatever it takes, as long as it takes, to defend itself was realized too haltingly. Now, thanks to Republican opposition in Congress, it could be a dead letter. Domestic politics has severely undermined the perception that America is a reliable ally. The war in Gaza is unpopular with the base of the president's party, prompting his near-constant rhetorical undermining of Israel. And even as Ukraine's front with Russia is buckling, the administration has told Kyiv that it shouldn't attack Russian oil installations for fear of inflated oil prices in an election year. It's almost as if Biden's don't doctrine gives allies just enough support to lose slowly. And that was The Problem with Biden's Don't Doctrine by Jonah Goldberg, and that was from the April 17th issue of The Dispatch. And next from the May issue of National Review Print Edition, Borderline Rude. This is by James Lilex. I'm considering a lawsuit against Canada. I think I have a good case. Canada's changed. They're weak. Easy pickings. When I was growing up in North Dakota, Canada was like a house on the other side of the block. Terra incognita, but familiar. The archetype, of course, was a Mountie. A square-jawed figure in a red uniform and a khaki hat. Seated on his trusty steed, Maple. Eyes scanning the horizon for fire or crime. What's that I spy? Someone has not returned the shopping cart to the corral. Hi-ya, Maple, away! He would arrest the miscreant because society realized that someone who violated the standards of niceness, decency, and community with such brazen contempt might go on to greater crimes, like selling substandard hockey sticks that splintered after one period. At the conclusion of his sentence, The criminal would go north to log or fish and live out of shame in private. Occasionally, there would be a war, and Canadians would perform with heroism and bravery. Also, everything printed was in French alongside the English, just to be nice to the people who spoke both languages but liked French more. The money had an old lady instead of a president. Americans loved this version of Canada. It was like a twin brother who inherited the parents' vacation home when they passed, while we got the mansion. He was fine with that. The scenery was nice, and if there weren't a lot of people, he could make friends with the beavers. The current archetype of Canadians down here in the States. Oh no, the government's frozen my bank account because someone overheard me say I don't think we should let in too many trans-Haitian cannibals, eh? Well, guess I'll climb into a suicide pod and be done with it. Have to love our free health care. No charge for parking at the suicide center. Of course, they only validate for an hour, but that should be enough. I'd like a church service, but the churches all got burned down in my province. Well, whoever did that probably had a good reason. Exaggeration? Of course. But as a recent notorious news story revealed, Toronto police are encouraging homeowners to hang their car keys near the door so burglars can find them with ease. Otherwise, they have to wake you up. They probably just want the car anyway, so meet them halfway. It's pathetic. Now I've met lots of Canadians over the last few years, mostly in Mexican resort bars. Smart, industrious, entrepreneurial, eminently decent business people. I would sing the virtues of the hardy stock who broke the cold, stiff skein of the prairies, erected great structures of stone and steel, unfurled a tapestry of Anglophone civilization across the continent, and dealt with a population that insisted on frog talk. I'd asked, how do you feel about your current culture of prissy progressivism, the cowering and cringing to cooks, the abandonment of national narratives, the spikes of the authoritarian snowshoe grinding on your face? Slight winces. After another tequila, I'd ask again and get heavy sighs and shrugs. Come on, guys, you can tell me. We're in Mexico. Trudeau doesn't have Stasi at the next table over. I'm on your side. The overreaching statist octopus should have its tentacles severed with the Acts of Liberty. Go ahead, speak your mind. After three tequilas, they might admit they have some concerns. Or, and they confess, quietly, with a hard look at the shot glass in their hand, to voting against Trudeau, at least in their heads. Five, and they ask me to explain the Second Amendment. This is the most Canadian thing ever. Not defend the Second Amendment, but I don't quite get what you fellows are up with that. Can you help me out? Why, yes. Yes, I can. I love those guys. I'm still thinking of suing Canada for reparations. In North Dakota in the 1960s, we were annually terrorized by Canadian air masses that swept down from the Arctic, dumped snow, froze fingers. Canada did nothing to stop them, didn't plant tall trees, didn't erect massive fans to blow the air back north, nothing. Treated the border like a joke. I have the feeling they pay up because this was an historical injustice. The past is all an injustice to some people. It's a wonder they don't burn the pictures of old Mounties. The horse was never asked if it consented to be ridden. And that was Borderline Rude by James Lilacs, and that was from the May edition of National Review print edition. And that concludes this edition of the News in Perspective. I'm Fritz Will for the Virginia Voice. This program is on the air daily at 3 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. You can listen. Also listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.